It's good to be back, and I truly appreciate that you perhaps have come back as well to join me for the next hour or so of discussion about all things art and comic related. I know the time gap between interviews has been extended in the past year or so, but that's really putting it mildly, but that's only a result of my available time for this webcast being shortened as well. You know, you're busy with family and stuff, and I'm no different. I've been busy with family working some exciting comic projects as well. But rest assured, though, that I have not forgotten the Boing podcast, and whenever I can reserve some free time for it, you know I will do so. Before we dive right into this month's interview, we need to break with a message from one of our many, many exciting sponsors. We'll be right back.
I hate machines!
Huh! Sorry, Rosie.
Why don't we go to the new Sprint store at Radio Shack, George? They have Sprint's easy-to-use products.
And the know-how of Radio Shack.
They even showed Astro how to use his mobile phone.
They could even help you, Mr. J.
Astro has a mobile phone?
Well, oh, Rhonda.
The new Sprint store at Radio Shack. You've got questions, we've got answers.
Hiya, Mr. Flintstone.
Greetings, Rocky, my boy. Pack of Winstons, please.
Oh, you like them Winston cigarettes, huh, Mr. Flintstone?
But of course, they really got something.
You bet your life. Folks who really enjoy smoking know it's what's up front that counts. And that's where Winston steps out ahead of the crowd with their exclusive filter blend. Choice Golden Tobaccos, specially selected and specially processed for filter smoke.
Hold it! Hold it!
And what you mean?
What are you pitching Winston's at me for? You know I never smoke nothing else.
Just practicing, Mr. Flintstone. Everybody knows that.
Winston tastes good, like a cigarette should.
Yeah.
See you soon, Rocky.
They call it limited animation, but I take exception to that label. It's the style of cartoons that this term applies to, and most notably used by Hanna-Barbera during the 50s and 60s, may have served the studio well in the bottom line. It did not, however, limit their mass appeal to the loyal audiences around the globe. Throughout history, there have been cartoons that have had masterful art, big budgets, and deep pockets behind them, yet fell flat on their proverbial faces. In the giant void filled with these forgettable shows, the so-called limited animation, produced from studios such as Hanna-Barbera during the 50s and 60s, had a special characteristic added to the mix that have allowed these shows to live forever in the hearts and minds of those that were lucky enough to experience them. That special ingredient? It's story. The shows were funny and were story-driven, and I was fortunate enough to have the great pleasure to talk with one of those story writers that worked his magic with so many of those charming cartoons. For those in the industry, the man needs no introduction. But to those of us who just reap the fruits from his labor while sitting transfixed to our little TVs on Saturday mornings, his name is Tony Benedict. Huckleberry Hound, Yogi Bear, Secret Squirrel, The Flintstones, The Jetsons, McGilla Gorilla, and the list goes on and on and on. Chances are, if you enjoyed any of these memorable shows while in your youth, you are indeed, then, the beneficiary of some of Tony Benedict's writing talents. I've got him next, right after these messages.
Ah, chili dogs with the wings. You're the best, Rosie.
You betcha, Mr. J.
Ah, boy. Ooh, uh-oh. Jane!
New Tums Quick Pack. Dissolves instantly.
George, what is it?
Heartburn's gone.
Never mind.
New Tums Quick Pack. Bring it on.
Where I began, 1936, I was born. Right in the middle of the Great Depression, which nobody knows about now. You know, it kills me. I was talking to my son-in-law about poverty. I said he's a wealthy man, and I said, you know, most wealthy people don't know what it's like to be poor. And he said, well, I was on food stamps when I was a kid, which is like, you know, pretty good. Actually, he did all right on food stamps, and we had all sorts of government to help. And he led a pretty good life for a kid, but there was none of that in 1936. Everybody was poor. There was no unemployment insurance. There were no food stamps. There was no health care, nothing. If you were a poor kid like we were, my mom, she had a fractured family. She was married three times. I was in the second husband batch. She had five kids. Her husband abandoned her, and she was, you know, working as a waitress, and she just couldn't take care of all the kids. So religious schools took up the slack then for poor people. So we were put in Catholic boarding schools, and for a little food and shelter, we were indoctrinated. That was the trade-off. But so that's from there, my mom finally found a third husband who was really a good man, and he took her and her kids and brought them up to Seattle, Washington, and I was about 10, I think, then. And we still went to a Catholic boarding school because they didn't have much money, but they were putting it together. And I was there for, like, until high school. And in high school, she finally got us home and had her whole family together. And then her husband died. So it's just as things got good. One good husband she had went away. And it was great fun those 2 years. I really enjoyed it, but the Catholic school thing really had an effect on me. We were always on a farm, out of touch with the rest of the world. Never saw a female. Didn't know anything about them or anything about how life really was on the outside. And so I'm in high school, and I'm having a very difficult time, and I was labeled as incorrigible. And I was actually bounced out of school for resisting. I actually asked one of those religious people, well, who made God? Because we got such an indoctrination, and that didn't go over well. So I went to my mom. She said, well, you're going to have to join the military. That's the only way to deal with incorrigible. So she took me down to the recruiting office, tried to get me in the Navy, but they said their quota was full of incorrigibles. But the Marine Corps had no limits, so I signed up for the Marine Corps for 3 years. From there, my oldest brother, Hal, had gotten a job at Walt Disney Studio because he was an artist, too. He could draw really well. And I had sent him some of my drawings and hoping he would submit them. Meantime, in the Marine Corps, I was on the went to basic training, and then from there, in basic training, they evaluated everybody, and anyone that had any brains at all, they would send to school. The rest of them, they'd send to combat training as cannon fodder.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so I went to, asked to get the U.S. Naval School of Photography and Motion Pictures in Pensacola, Florida, and I got it. So I went to that school and learned all about filmmaking the old-fashioned way, which is useless now. But I did learn, state-of-the-art stuff then. They didn't care about aesthetics. They just wanted you to shoot film, like documentaries and so forth. So I learned all the basic techniques, how to record sound, how to shoot film and edit and so forth. And after that, I was sent up to Cherry Point Naval Air Station, where they had a Marine Corps detachment, and I was assigned to that. But I worked on the base paper, and then I was also on the boxing team, which I had done in high school. We had a boxing team in high school, and I was on that boxing team. So here I was at Cherry Point working on the drawing cartoons on the base paper in the morning and training on the boxing team, doing nothing very Marine-like or military. And we would travel and box with the Army and the Navy people at different bases. And so I was getting pretty good. We were drawing some good crowds, and I actually had an offer to turn pro when I got out, and I was really looking forward to that. But meanwhile, I was, you know, waiting for Hal to report on his drawings that he submitted of mine to the people that hire there. And I got a letter from him, and he said, I got you into a training program. So, bang, the boxing career went out the window. I jumped in my old car. It was like a 48 Oldsmobile, an old used car, and I drove 3,000 miles out to California onto the Disney lot and got into a training program for about a week or so, where they just familiarize you with everything, and then I'm assigned to an animator. There were no animation schools back then, zero. The only way you could learn animation was in a studio, in the old medieval style of apprentice and journeyman workshop, and that and the master. So I got my training there, worked on Sleeping Beauty and 101 Dalmatians as an in-betweener and a breakdown artist. And then I got into a unit that was a TV unit headed up by Bob McCrae, who was an old Disney animator, who had put together this crew at Walt's request to reuse old animation in their new TV show, Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color.
Right.
So we were repurposing old material from the morgue, taking all the beautiful drawings out and adapting them to whatever was required for the new show. And it was about as good a time as I ever had. Disney was so different from the Marine Corps.
I bet.
We had a theatrical live stage group. We used all their facilities, put on plays. We had baseball teams and just lots of, you know, extra things, screenings. So I also had some fun with the Mouseketeers. I was dating Darlene Gillespie, cute little super talented girl. And it was just so good. And then there was the layoff, which I'd never heard of it in my life. What was a layoff? Well, well, I was laid off, and I was really jolted. But there was, because the whole business had, it was starting to, you know, theatrical cartoons were out the door. They cost too much. Originally, the major studios would make short theatrical cartoons to play ahead of their feature films.
Right, right.
And it was thought that these cartoons were, if people going to see a movie were going to flip a coin over which one to see, that a Tom and Jerry cartoon might make a difference. So, but after the cost got so high, that didn't work anymore, so they closed on all the shorts studios all across the board at all the major studios.
Yeah.
And only feature films were made by Disney then.
Are we talking the 50s here? Is this like the 50s?
This is 1957.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And Bill and Joe had, they were at MGM, and MGM closed down. So they started up a new store, a new studio, with the help of George Sidney and a couple other people from Columbia Pictures, who funded it. And so they were rolling along, starting to put out Rough and Ready and a few small, cheap shows. And I was over at the UPA working with Eddie Friedman, learning more and more about animation. And Eddie was a great guy, hilarious sense of humor, especially because Eddie had lost his entire family in the Holocaust. He was the only survivor. And but he had this great sense of humor. You know,
that's hard to imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and at the same time, while I was there, they were doing Mr. Magoo's show, so I submitted a few scripts. And they bought them, and pretty soon I wasn't working with Eddie anymore. I was a writer. And that was working out really nice. And at the time, there was another writer there. He was a live-action writer. And I always did storyboards. So, but he said that Hanna-Barbera was selling, had sold the Flintstones. This was the first year, and they hadn't even started the first one, but they had it sold, and they were starting. And so Phil said, let's write a script, and then we'll take it over to them and submit it. So we sat down and wrote a script, but it was a script. It wasn't a storyboard, because that was Phil's style. Anyway, we submitted it to Alan Dinehart, who was the associate producer at Hanna-Barbera. And Alan hired me, but not film, because I had animation training and I could do storyboards. So Phil was disappointed. But
yeah,
me,
I bet.
Yeah, it was. And I never saw Phil again, or I should apologize to him or something. Yeah. So I started over there at Hanna-Barbera. And just first I was working on, first I had an office, an office of my own. I just couldn't believe that.
Yeah. Really.
And nice fat paychecks that I just couldn't believe I ever had. And I was working right next to, on either side of me were two other offices. One was Mike Maltese and the other was Warren Foster. You know those guys?
Yes, I'm very familiar, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so, they were like in their 50s, and I'm like 22 years old, 23, I think. And so I'm just sucking up everything those guys had to say, and they were hilarious. They knew all the old gags, all the old jokes. In fact, most of the stuff that we were doing was just repurposing old cartoons from a lot of those Yogi Bears stories. Go back and look at Warner Brothers and MGM cartoons, and they look very familiar.
Yeah.
But it was a new way of doing it, and it worked out beautifully. The shows were a hit. So, let's see. What else did they got?
I think personally, the limited animation today, you look back on it, and has a characteristic and charm all of its own. It's to me, it's what makes it special. I loved it.
It did. It was all that extra. If it had good writing, it worked out beautifully.
Right.
But that's what it required. And we all were animation trained, like Tom and Jerry. No dialogue. You could tell a story and get feelings and emotion across, without dialogue.
Right.
You can do it with dialogue, but you do it without. And so we all thought visually. We would rank visually, but there were only three of us there, and so when they sold the Flintstones and the Jetsons and Tomcat, they had to bring in live-action writers because there just weren't enough people who knew how to write and animate. So I did a lot of inserts on the live-action scripts because they didn't have any of the funny Flintstone gags, which are mostly visual Stone Age gags. And so I would do inserts for all of that and then go back and do my own shows. The process was I would submit an idea to Joe on a Flintstone or whatever else was required. And he would toss it around with me, and then I'd go back and write do a rough storyboard, bring it back into Joe. We'd go over it again. He'd add stuff, take stuff out, and Then I'd go back and do the finish board. Maybe then he would do a few more changes, but not many. Then it would go over to Bill Hanna, who would have a production board made out of it, which was another device that Hanna Bob Beer didn't invent, but they perfected it, the storyboard, production storyboard, mm-hmm. where all the production information was on the board, scene numbers and takes and camera moves and references to other material and so forth and so on. So let's see.
Now you, so one? you really had a which I think is I you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's a unique situation where you had a direct connection with Joe Barbera and you didn't have like a middleman or anybody else.
That was yeah.
In the
that
way.
Was the yeah. The whole shows were that way because the television networks when they first bought animation, they didn't know even how it was made. So they all they knew was they were cheap and they were coming out fast and they were drawing big audiences. And the sooner you got them out, the better. Bill and Joe were making a lot of money just on the production. They would, you know, do it for like $20,000 an episode and sell it for $50. Meanwhile, complaining to the networks that they just needed more money because they couldn't get it out in time. And they would always get more money. So they were doing so well on that that there was no input from the advertisers at that point. So I never saw a person from the network, and they arrived on the air pretty much the way I'd written them, and that was super. I don't think anybody enjoys that kind of stuff anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe The Simpsons. I don't know how they do it, but they have a great show. They didn't. I love that show. They, you know, they say what they want, and they get away with stuff you couldn't say in live action or do. So I just assume they have a lot of creative freedom over there, but
yeah,
that's sort of how it was with Hanna-Barbera.
How did you get your ideas though? Did you and how much time did you have to get an idea? Did you like go drive around and it came to you? Did it just happen? Or, I mean, was there a process or?
You know, I never thought about it. I just sat down and I had seen a lot of. I always watch shows like Phil Silvers, The Honeymooners. Those kind of shows were like what I watched, and they were sitcoms.
Right.
And, of course, I watched a million short cartoons, and I had watched a lot of Hanna-Barbera's. When I come back from work at UPA, the Hanna-Barbera had the Huck Show and Yogi Bear Show. They were on at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It was syndicated. People were watching these shows in beer bars. They had signs up, Huckleberry Hound, 5 p.m., you know. And
oh, my gosh.
They were appealing to adults. And when the networks, the demographics come back showing this, that's what sold the Flintstones. Because they knew that adults were watching this stuff. Later on, they flaps it back into the old juvenile thing again, though, but...
Yeah. You were credited for amongst many of the Flintstone episodes, but one of them was Flintstone and the Lion. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, that I love that one. It was fantastic.
Bringing home that little
cat,
and then it grows up to be something else. Yeah, that's I like that too. That was one of my faves. Yeah, that's one of those that pretty got on there the way I wrote it. I loved it. It was great.
Yeah,
fun.
I remember specifically that seeing a scene where Fred's watching TV and the cat has his arm around him and they're both sitting on the chair. It's great.
That's and we took that a little further with the Jetsons. They had Astor with his arm around George. I've used that a few times.
And Jetsons, by the way, that was one of your favorites to work on, right?
Yeah. The Coming of Astro was probably my favorite. Jetson.
Now,
how they got him. It was the same story as the Lion one. It was Elroy. The dog followed him home, but really he dragged the dog.
Yeah.
And so anyway, that's
now
everything. Nothing's new except what's been forgotten.
Now, I'm sure there are some crazy characters at working at Hanna-Barbera that, as far as personnel.
Yeah, it was required that you be a character.
And you brought your video camera, you and I believe somebody else brought...
No, there was no video then. This was 1960.
Okay.
I had an 8mm camera and stills. And we could go around and we shot, you know, whatever we wanted. There was zero security. No one was concerned about that stuff then. So we got a lot of pictures. And Jerry Eisenberg, he started about the same time I did, too. And he and I together shot a lot of stuff, and we kept a lot of still photographs as well and drawings. And much of that is at the core of my film.
You still have that footage. Now, I was going to ask you the next thing about, were there any particular tools, pencils, whatever, certain kind of paper? Were you ever that sold on specific brands, or did you just draw with...
Pencil and nine-panel piece of storyboard paper. Those are my tools.
All right. Well, what do you think about it? I was curious to know also what you think about today's technology and the software that's out there now that they're using.
Well, yeah, I love it and hate it.
Yeah.
You know, I love what can be done with it, and I don't like what's being done with it. You know.
Yeah.
But I think, well, as the Simpsons is an example. I love that show. Futurama, I love that show. That's great. That's really using both techniques. They use cell animation or paper animation and computer animation. They put those two together beautifully. It's still mainly drawing and writing that makes that show, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. Totally agree.
Yeah.
Now I know at some point here you've embarked on this the Yellowstone Christmas special, and you left HB to do that. But when did things at Hanna-Barbera start to change for, I guess I would say, for the worse, in your opinion?
Yeah.
When did that start to happen? Was it when you started looking for that other project, the Yellowstone project, or was it happening already before that? Or
no, I was very happy and content at Hanna-Barbera and figured I was going to spend my entire career there. Mm-hmm. And but it seemed more and more that the advertisers started becoming aware of what a great profit center this was, animated cartoon. They looked more into it and started slowly getting into it and making suggestions and just changing the whole thing. They were more in charge than Bill or Joe. And I could see it creeping in, and we could see what was happening. And like on the Jetsons, you know, they stuck in that Orbity character, which was quickly an advertiser. They wanted to sell a toy.
Right.
And every show became a commercial for a product. The Smurfs, even the title was the name of the product. And humor was gone. There was no more funny shows after 1967 at Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I didn't fit in. Humor was all I had to offer. And I had written this and storyboarded this Yellowstone Christmas, and I had submitted it to Joe. And he said, there's no villain in it. You know, great. So I was really heartbroken. I thought he would grab it and make it. But that was the point where I realized there was no satisfying future there at Hanna-Barbera. So I took my script, and I was, which was a storyboard, and I was telling my brother Frank about it and ran it by him. I was, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do with it. And Frank was a commercial pilot. He was a private commercial pilot, and he was flying this guy named Marvin Judd, who was head of a what they called conglomerate back in the 60s. you know, a major holding company that had other companies. And they were in Canada, up in British Columbia. My brother's in Seattle, so he while flying this guy up to Vancouver, he told him about my story. And he, this guy got very interested and says, well, I'd like to talk to him about that. Maybe we can do something. So Frank set it up, and I went up to Vancouver, and it was in right around Christmas time, and it was snowing, and Marvin Judd took me to his home with his family. He had three little children, and we had a nice meal, and then by the fireplace, he sat us all down. He says, now tell them your story.
Wow.
So I pitched the whole thing to his family, and I walked out of there with a check to get this thing started.
So wow.
I went back down to California and put my crew together, a small crew, and we made the film in about 6 months. It was a half hour long, and we were going to try and sell it after we made it. That was the reverse of the usual plan. So I went to all three networks with it and got rejected by all of them. Tried to get some advertisers, went to various ad agencies, nothing. And so I had it made, but I went, then I went to Warner Brothers, right, and asked them what they could do with a half-hour film, and they said, well, you know, maybe if you were to add some footage to it, bring it to feature length, we could release it as a Saturday and Sunday matinee. Great, you know, I had no choice. I grabbed that. That was an offer. They gave me some money to lengthen it. We added a few songs, and it didn't do it any good. They made it, you know, like them just barely qualified for a feature, 60 minutes, I think it was. And so then when it was finished, I brought it to them, and I said, yeah, that's great, but the company was just sold to Seven Arts in Canada.
Oh, no.
So the new people came in, and they said, oh, we don't want anything with this, you know, sorry about that. So I'm back out on the street again trying to sell this.
Sell it.
And I went to several of the major distributors and finally wound up down in a place called Hollywood, Florida, oddly enough.
And
there was a little distribution company called RNS Distribution. They distributed two kinds of films, children's films and softcore porn films.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm sitting there in Shelley Shermer's office. He's the guy there. He's got two one-sheets up. One of them is like Cinderella or Thumbelina, and over here was a Debbie Garrett kind of poster. But it's the same actress in both posters.
Oh, Lord.
So Shelley says, yeah, you know, okay. He gives me some money. I pay off Warner Brothers, and he runs, he did 115 prints, 35-millimeter prints, very expensive. And they released him on Thanksgiving Day in 1969. And the first year, it made $500,000 at 50 and 75 cents a ticket.
Wow.
All across the nation. And
Of which you received?
Nothing. No, I keep saying, Shelley, this is terrific. Where's the money? He says, well, we had a lot of expenses. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
He did. Yeah, well, that was a lot of prints, and it cost a lot of money. But this went on for like 4 or 5 years, and I'm getting nothing back. And I'm trying to explain this to my backers, and they were a little bit annoyed. So I actually, with some of the money I got from Shelley, I was able to repay their investment, and or a portion of it. I couldn't do it all, but we settled, and they actually wound up owning the film, but they let it lapse into public domain. It was every year it was making money. And it was in KTLA here in L.A. Every year they would run it. And I think that went up to like for 15, 20 years. It's still running different places. It's been duplicated and DVD'd and everything all around. The only way I was able to keep track of all this was because of the music royalties that were involved. Because I had written some of the music, and I got all these reports from all over the world that this film was being played, and I was getting music royalties, but nothing else from it. So that was the end of my independent productions, and then I went back to work at Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah, that's quite a story. Joe was okay, right? Joe was okay with you coming back and all that, obviously.
Yeah, he told me when I left it I'd be back. He was right. Yeah, we got along really well. I really loved that guy. And so, you know, I'm back at Hanna-Barbera and doing Jetsons 20 years later. You know, you can't do that with a live action and everybody's the same age.
Yeah.
So,
but Jetsons, I think at that time, had kind of lost some of its, like you said, its luster.
Oh, yeah, they didn't care at all. They just wanted to get out, you know, shows. They were making their money off the shows. They wanted 65 episodes, and they already had the 26 that were originally made. Mm-hmm. And so, it was awful. And so I left Hanna-Barbera after that, but pretty much it.
Now, you're also credited with working on the Pink Panther, Laugh and a Half Hour. Is that?
Yeah, that's right. I went to work over there with Frizz Freleng, who I had worked with Frizz. I'd done some freelance stuff with him when he was at Warner's. Now it was to Patty Freleng. They were doing the Pink Panther. And I didn't do any Ant and the Aardvarks. I just did the Pink Panthers. And a couple of Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck TV specials. Primetime stuff.
Now, I'm sure being that Pink Panther didn't talk, you really had, it was a lot of, I mean, almost all visual, your storyboarding, right? It was, because you did, the way you wrote, you pretty much were storyboarding as well as writing, correct?
Simultaneously, yeah.
Right, which was unique in a way. I mean, it was not that.
It wasn't. It was the way it always was. Back in the day, you know, at all the studios, all those cartoon studios, there were no typewriters. It was all written that way. It was only when Hanna-Barbera on TV had so much work that they couldn't, that this wasn't enough writers.
Wow. That's quite a story. What a career at that point, man. So now we're in the 70s at this point. Was it late or mid to late 70s? And then, where did you go after working with Fritz?
I did Fritz, and then I sort of like was burnt out, and I was actually having trouble finding work. They didn't need funny gag writers anymore, and I was actually turned down for jobs, so I just gave up on the animation business and moved back up to Seattle, where I had some family, and I got a job. I couldn't find a freaking job. I actually wound up as a doorman at the Hilton Hotel, working there for a while, trying to find some kind of work. And I saw an ad in a paper looking for cartoonists to work at Sierra Online, which was a computer gaming company. So I went over there and showed my stuff to them. Fortunately, they were doing like Warner Brothers stuff, and I knew all the characters. Actually, I just forgot. I actually was doing that at a T-shirt company. They had a deal with Warner Brothers, and they needed a cartoon guy, and I knew all those characters so well. I went working there designing T-shirts. Wow. And from there, I found that other job at Sierra Online and went over there. And that involved some animation, too, so I had a break there. And there was a young exec there, Rod Mikielski was his name, and he was a cartoonist, and he loved my stuff, and he gave me this job and really trained me a lot in computer animation, and that was a big boost. So that was a good job for a while. I wasn't paying a lot, but I was learning a great deal about that way of making animation.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went down to, he was hired by Disney.
Oh, jeez.
And he went down to Southern California, and he was there for a while, and then he brought me down. So I went back to Disney, Disney Online, and the computer game company, and I went through their whole introduction like I was a brand new employee. You know, I had been to Disney before, and it was so different. It was less like a Magic Kingdom and more like an evil empire.
Oh, jeez.
It was really harsh. And then they had a huge layoff again. I got laid off again at Disney with a lot of other people.
Yeah.
And so I was really burnt out then. But I found a gig at Getty Images as an art director, working with all this stock footage and editing it and supplying advertisers with whatever they wanted. It was
I'm very familiar with Getty Images. Yeah, they're huge. Yeah.
Yep. Right, they are big. So
so you kind of reinvented yourself, really. It seems
Right. And by then I reached like the retirement age, and I was able to
Well, what about go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I pretty much retired after that and started working on small gigs here and there and working on my film. I've been working on that for decades.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about some of the current stuff that you're there. There was something called, was it Bezongo?
Oh, that is a, that's a project done up in Seattle by a couple of producers. I went up to Seattle, I guess it was last year, to speak at the Cartoonist Northwest meeting. Mm-hmm. And at that meeting were these two producers, and they said they were making a documentary on cartoonists in the Northwest area. So they asked me if I would do an interview. And I did, and I wasn't real well prepared for it because it was real quick. I had to do it the next night, actually. I just met these people. So they came to my hotel, and we did that interview, and then that's was over, and that's the last I heard of them.
Yeah, I think
it's going to open in Seattle Film Festival this June, their film.
Yeah, I saw a little bit, like the little teaser they had, a trailer. I think it was maybe about a week or two ago. It's still, you know, still active. I just don't, you know, that'll be curious to see how well that plays out, you know. But you have a blog, in case those, you know, people aren't aware. And how did that come about? You just decided to, for those that don't know.
More than a year ago, I wanted to, I've been working on my own film pretty much on my own, taking forever to get it done, and I thought I would try a Kickstarter program to get it funded so I could hire people and get it out quicker, but that failed, so I didn't get that, so I was back to doing it all myself. And about 3 months ago, I called up an old friend of mine who was a super film editor, and I asked him if he would help me out because I had all this material and it was just too overwhelming. So we sat down and he agreed to work with me on this, and we've been working on it all this time, and we're just now finishing up. In fact, I think we're going to have it done next weekend, and we're going to submit it first. We're going to premiere it at the Telluride Film Festival.
Oh, wow.
And that's where we are. But my film, if you want to hear about that.
Yes, I was going to ask you if you.
Started out as a Hanna-Barbera documentary because I had all this footage.
Mm-hmm.
But It's winding up to be more a story of my career and Hanna-Barbera, because they were intertwined. And I tried real hard, and I think I've succeeded in not using the usual interviews, same old questions, same old answers that are everywhere. Every interview I've done has pretty much been the same.
Right.
Same questions, and you know, they make the same film. But mine isn't like that. I do not appear in it as my present self. I've got lots of footage of myself from way back from high school. I always had a camera with me taking pictures. And so I was able to document those early days. And in the Marine Corps, I had all my film and photography training, so I was shooting film of me boxing and training and all, you know, I have all that original stuff. So I have lots of footage of myself and my career from the military to the all the way through.
Wow.
So I'm putting all that way, and also I'm an animated character of myself telling the story. A younger version of me, and I have caricatures of Bill and Joe, and they animate, and all the other people, Jerry, and a lot of characters are live, actual people that are all dead now, animators and artists of all kinds that are in the film, and I think everyone in the business will see stuff that hasn't been seen anywhere on the planet.
I think that sounds fantastic, and I'm not just saying that because I mean that really. I foresee that at some point, you know, you could get that like on DVD. You know, you may think it's a narrow focused audience in the beginning, but I really think you'll be surprised how popular that could be.
Well, I'm being more encouraged. I have more than enough footage to make a feature film out of it. When I bring in all the Disney stuff that I have, I just touch on Disney. Maybe there's 2 minutes of it in this film, which is now 20 minutes long, but I could make that easily 15 minutes. I've got drawings of myself and gags we've done of the Musketeers and just the whole thing. And also that the making of Santa and the Three Bears, I've got all that documented with the staff and crew and that whole story. So there's a, I think, great feature film there. And I'm hoping that this 20-minute version will generate funding for the feature film. And that's what I'm...
Then you could produce that, yeah. I hope you do get a lot of buzz for that, because that's... I'm definitely going to try to keep my eyes on that, because that sounds so neat. I think, because like you said, it's a different perspective. It's not the same old thing, you know?
If you look at my blog, you'll see the flavor of that. That's what it is. It's like that.
A lot of that
stuff you see on there is going to be in the film.
That's fantastic. Now, speaking of that, you had a thing on there, storyboard it looked like up there called Foxy Foodie.
Oh yeah, right. That was a thing that I wrote and submitted to Hanna-Barbera, and it never went anywhere.
God.
I did that when I was up in Seattle back in the 90s, and never went anywhere with it. They didn't understand.
Sad. What a waste! I look at that, and I'm like, why isn't that produced? Why was that not produced? Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds really. That sounds exciting. And I was going to ask you back a little bit earlier, did you ever have an opportunity at Hanna-Barbera to meet some of the voice talent?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They were a part of it. And I was a good friend with Dawes Butler. I did him a, I drew up a drawing of his face in the middle, and he was surrounded by all the voices, the character voices that he did. So I made a drawing of all the characters, and he used that for years as his calling card.
That's fantastic. That had big.
Alan Reed, yeah, and B. Benedict. The Alan Dinehart was a big backer of mine. I owe him a lot because he was the first one to bring me to introduce me to Joe. And when he introduced me to Joe, he said, "Tony, I want you to meet Joe Barbera. I've known him for 20 years, and now you know him as well as I do." So that line and gag is in the film.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. That's a
he was a great character. He was from New York, and there were other people from, they were like old school New Yorkers, Mike and Warren, and they were, it was like being on the Bilko show. They had that great sense of humor that cracked me up, and it was my kind of stuff, too.
Yeah, I can only imagine that there really probably wasn't a lot of room. If you were thin-skinned, you weren't going to last, you know? I bet you had to have a really good sense of humor and to really get along. Yeah.
Well, there wasn't quite the sensitivity that there is now to, like, jokes about women. And, you know, you just had to be, you have to be real careful now because
you
can be easily offended. But then, you know, if you were short, they would call you shorty. You were fat, they'd call you tubby. If you stuttered, that was it. But nobody was offended.
Right. I totally see that, and that's the way I think. Personally, I think it's a shame that we lost that. But you know, we're like you said, it's a different time. You know,
right?
But was Alan Reed a pretty good person? He looked like he'd be a really funny guy. The guy, the voice for Fred Flintstone.
He was. I used to listen to him on the radio in Life with Luigi, an old radio show about Italian immigrants who were in a school learning about America. And in fact, Alan Dinehart took me down to my first Flintstone recording, and there was of course Alan and B. Benedict and Mel Blanc and Gene Vanderpyle, and that whole thing was hilarious. They spent as much time doing jokes and laughing and trying to top each other as they did actually recording the script. And Dinehart was like it, too. He would do jokes, too, but they had so much fun, and it was like doing a radio show to them. They were all experienced at that, so they really knew what they were doing. Yeah, I had so much fun just watching all that stuff go down.
Wow, that sounds like it would have been a great...
And Judy Jetson, she was... Janet Waldo, and Janet was on a radio show produced by Alan Dinehart many years before, where she was a teenager. It was called Corliss Archer. And I heard that on the radio, and I fell in love with that because she was a teenage girl, and I was, you know, maybe 12 or 13. And I really got excited about her. And then the first time Alan introduced me to her, boy, that all flashed back to me. But it was great, and I was so happy to meet her. And I told her I was crazy about her a long time ago. But now she was married, and no more of that stuff. Well, so that's the actor's thing.
Another thing I always noticed, not to always harp go back to the Flintstones, but it was a pretty big part of my life growing up. But I always noticed which I thought was odd, but still so unique. And I think it brings the charm to the show was that if you looked at the background, sometimes you'd see like pink trees or purple trees, and whose decision was that to add some funky colors in the background? You'd always see like some strange colors, but it made it pop and it made it work as far as I'm concerned.
Well, everybody in the studio contributed to making these films less expensive because that was their job. And the people in the background department made those calls pretty much. They were pretty autonomous. They would, you know, take it to, I think Joe approved backgrounds and anything creative. Bill was more on the production side of it, except for the music. So I don't know who made those color decisions, but most likely it was, there was, let's see, Fernando and Lotzi, Art Lotzi. The background people themselves made those calls.
Made those calls, yeah. That's, to me, it makes it. I mean, and same with the looping background, of course, because that was probably to save money as well.
Right, you know. Everybody thought it was an intentional gag. That's how it came
I loved it. And well, yeah. You know, I go back, I was little, pretty small at the time, so some of it I didn't catch, but as you know, as I got older, like, they're using the same background. I saw that tree a second ago, you know, in that house. It's great, yeah. Though.
I mean, well, that was the whole thing. In my film, I also explain and demonstrate limited animation, how it was different. And very briefly, but in a way that I think is very clear. I would like match a drawing of a same pose of like Yogi Bear in profile. And next to him is that bear from the Jungle Book.
Oh, yeah. Baloo or something? Baloo?
Yeah, Baloo. And a very complicated drawing. The two together, you can see how much easier it is to draw a Yogi and how much less time it would take. And also, I ran a clip of a 8-frame walk cycle, and then I would pull out 4 drawings, and you'd look at the same drawings, and to most people, you couldn't tell the difference in the walk. That's cutting your cost in half.
Wow.
You didn't have to ink those four drawings. You didn't have to paint them. You didn't have to shoot them, and you could use them again and again. So it was... things like that. And also in the writing, we wrote efficiently because we knew what works in animation. We understood the process. We know, here, you repeat this background, we just repeat this drawing, just use them again and again, different attitudes, and that would just go into the production line, and they would all understand it because we were speaking the same language. With live-action writers, they had to... have somebody make a storyboard out of it and go through that extra process.
I can only imagine, like, and something like 101 Dalmatians. Now, I could be incorrect, but I'm assuming there was a lot of rotoscoping going on there.
Yeah.
So yeah, that would take...
I worked on a 101 Dalmatians.
That would take...
Xerox thing that introduced then.
Right, right. But there had to be a ton of cells for that. I mean, for the fluid motion and for, well, really all of Disney stuff back then. But
yeah, it was all labor intensive. Lots of cells and those dots in betweening a Dalmatian dog animating. It was an eye strainer.
Oh, I never thought of that. Oh my God!
Try to animate all those dogs with dots all over them.
Yeah, and you can't have the dots floating around where they don't need to be. So, gosh. Oh, my God. I feel sorry for whoever had to do that. And that's back when none of that stuff went overseas, correct? I mean, it was all...
No,
stayed.
That overseas thing didn't happen until the late 60s.
Right. And that, of course, was the... pretty much, a lot of people will say that was a decline of... a lot of the animation here, but
it was, but I don't think it was the system because other people like again, the Simpsons, all their stuff is sent overseas, and they still have it coming back the way they wanted, and they controlled it, and we could have done that too at Hanna-Barbera, but they were so concentrated on getting these shows out fast. Because they made a lot of money real quick when they got them out. The longer it took to make them, the more money it cost. So
that's incredible. Yeah,
it wasn't so much the system, but the way it was used. Because those shows, if Bill and Joe had just kept their integrity on their shows, like Disney did, Disney never let their characters be drawn improperly, or they wouldn't dilute it.
Right,
but Hanna-Barbera made some pretty crappy shows just because
of that, for the dollar. I know there's a lot of young artists that will listen to this podcast, and I was curious to know where you kind of cut your teeth with like figure drawing and all that, because there wasn't a lot of art schools. So where did you like master the you know, the art of drawing the human figure and all that, because obviously you have to have that foundation before you progress forward.
Well, I guess I'm an example of one who didn't have that kind of training. I went to art school for about 2 weeks, I have a color deficiency. And when they started talking about color, I was lost.
That was it.
Yeah. And so I only had that brief bit of training there. But even so, I would have went on, but I got hired at Disney. When I got out of the Marine Corps, I was actually working at Disney and going to art school for those, whatever it was, a month or so. But I was also getting trained at Disney, and it was far better training, and they had live models than we could
reference.
At night we would do those kind of drawings. And in fact, I remember one episode there was on a sound stage, and all us apprentice trainees were on the sound stage where they would have this light drawing class. So there would be a nude model up there, and we were always sketching her, and right behind the nude model was this big door, you know, like an airplane hangar where they go up and down.
Right.
And so while we were drawing, this thing starts, door starts slowly rising, and you can see all these feet, like back lot workers. And it goes way up, and they all, oh, wow, they started hollering at this, making ridiculous noises about this nude babe and everything.
Yeah, oh, gosh.
So they were told to quiet down and get out of there.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's my live action training, but the training at Disney was superior to Art Center School by far. There was no point in staying on there.
Yeah, it's ironic. I've listened to some shows and interviews where even today they say that not a lot of the art schools just aren't what they're cracked up to be. You know, kids are leaving art school and they're like, okay, I'm lost. You know, I've kind of lost the love for drawing, and how do I get it back? And this, what I learned really wasn't practical for what, you know, what's really needed. And that's kind of sad, really, for what you spend.
It's really sad. I've been looking for animators on my job, on my film, and I get resumes from people that are just simply spectacular. Wow, they get all kinds of titles and experience. They worked everywhere. But when they sit down and I ask them to draw, they can't freaking draw, you know?
Yeah.
And they go to, like, degrees and everything. They just, I don't know what they teach you in school, but one real example of a non-trained person was Iwo Takamoto. Are you familiar with him?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, that guy. Scooby-Doo. Yeah.
He never, ever had a drawing lesson in his life. Never went to school, nothing. That guy,
hard to believe,
was a natural genius.
That's a gift. That's a gift.
It is, yeah. It is.
Unbelievable. Gift. Well, that's great. Well, this really concludes the interview, Tony. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Todd. I hope we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the interview as much as I did with Tony Benedict, the genius behind many of the wonderful cartoons that we all watched and continue to watch were generated out of the 50s and 60s. And it's timeless work. Check out his blog as well at thelastcartoonery.com. That is a fun-filled trip down memory lane. And during the time period when cartoons were created with that heart, passion, and sense of pride that is quite often missing in the cartoons of today. Not always, but quite often. Also, you can check out most of Tony's work on DVD collections, available through Amazon, of course, and amongst a myriad of other retailers, as well as on the Boomerang Channel. Me? Well, I'm Todd Dolce, and I am signing out for the day. I hope you enjoyed the interview, and please come back and visit again the next time on the Boing Podcast. Take care, and good night. that's another webcast. What'd you think, Dan? That was a pretty good show. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was great. Did you? I mean, I really thought it was a good show. Tony was a great guest, and we're still on. People, they're still listening? You people are still out there listening? Really? Seriously? Listen, I'm plugged up. I'm congested. I don't know what's going on, but I'm whipped. So, really, you want more? Are they... All right, you're right. You know what? We're going to slap on the Busch Beer commercial from the Flintstones, and then that's it. I'm telling you, cutting it off right after that. You guys got to go. You got to go. Get a life.
It takes know-how to work in a beer business.
Yeah, and we got no know-how. Know-how.
Hey, Fred, look outside. Mr. Slate, and he's starting to come in.
Hey, Barney, I just got an idea to make it our jobs back. Come on! Here, disguise yourself with these towels. I'll use this mop.
Bartender! Bartender, I want service!
Coming! What kind of beer, sir?
Any kind, you lunkhead, any kind!
Ooh, you need a Busch. You're all tensed up.
No wonder. My two key men quit me yesterday, and I can't get anyone to do the job like they can.
Why don't you ask them to come back?
Oh, they'd like that. They'd crow about it. Never.
Drink your Busch, stranger. It'll do you good.
Calm down, Slate, honey. Give him another chance.
Hey, you're right. When you're due for a beer, this Busch does it. Would you help me get my men back, bartender?
Sure. What are their names? I'll get them back for you.
Their names are Fred Flintstone and Barney,
Rubble. Barney Rubble.
Yeah, that's right. Barney Rubble.
Well, we just happen to know them, and we'll guarantee that they'll be back on the job in the morning. If we can tell them that you'll give them a raise.
No. No, that's out. No raise. Never.
Drink some more Busch, stranger. On the house.
Well, okay.
Be reasonable, Tiger. You can afford them.
Well, it's only money. Tell them that they'll get their raise. Good night.
Good night, sir.
So long, stranger.
Good night, Fred and Barney. And don't be late in the morning.
How about that? Mr. Slate knew it was us all the time.
Yeah, he missed us as much as we missed him.
This calls for a celebration, Barney boy.
Right, Fred? When you're due for a beer, Busch does it.
You can't say beer better than Busch.
Yeah, but I'm a dude.